I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what workers sacrifice in service to maximizing shareholder value and why that goal doesn't guarantee economic growth or class mobility. My guest for the hour will be public affairs professor Stephen Perlstein, who says equality of opportunity will not create a just society if no effort is made to try and equalize incomes. We'll talk with him about possible remedies for what ails American capitalism, including more corporate profit sharing, a rethinking of the geographic boundaries of public schools, and a reinterpretation of antitrust law. Our conversation starts after a short break. Playing corporate raider Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas uttered one of the most famous movie lines of all time.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
The movie was meant as a cautionary tale. Gekko goes down in the end when his one-time protege wears a wire, catches him admitting to illegal activity. But a lot of American CEOs must have fallen asleep in the theater before that happened, because it seems like many of them framed Gordon Gekko more as superhero than supervillain.
Greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As my guest will remind us, 21st century corporations tend to prioritize shareholder profits over just about everything else they do. But it hasn't always been this way, and it can't remain this way if we want to practice a morally justifiable form of capitalism. Stephen Perlstein is Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University and a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post. His book is called Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed Is Not Good, Opportunity Is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What evidence have you seen that Americans are losing faith in the benefits of the free market economy?
We got a hint of this a few years ago when Harvard University did a poll of millennials across the country, and they found that less than half supported capitalism. There have been more recent polls, for example, Gallup polled Democrats and found that 57% had a favorable opinion of socialism. Now, whether millennials knew exactly what capitalism is, or the Democrats who were polled knew exactly what socialism is, I think is not particularly relevant. What is relevant is that there is, I think, a sense of unease about the kind of capitalism we have in the United States, which is somewhat distinct and unique. And some of that has to do with the fact that some people have been left behind in the last 30 years. And they haven't and haven't really shared in the prosperity that half the country certainly has experienced. But the other thing I think is even those who have done well are feeling like we've sort of run off the moral rails, that there's something grubby and distasteful about it, and it offends our moral instincts on a fairly regular basis.
Lots of business leaders and lots of politicians, mostly but not exclusively on the right, embrace rhetoric about the stifling limitations of excessive regulation. And the deregulation boom and the tax cuts of the 1980s did seem to supercharge the economy. What kinds of regulations and taxes existed before those changes?
Well, some of the regulation for people who weren't around before the 1980s was actually pretty oppressive. The government used to regulate which airlines could fly to which cities and what they could charge. We used to have a single phone company monopoly until this company called MCI came along and challenged that, and there was, you know, years and years of court cases. But again, the government used to pick which company provide us with phone service. Everyone got the same thing, and not only did that company provide us the service, but they provided us with the with the telephones, and we could have any phone that they wanted to sell us. And the rates were regulated. Rail rates were regulated. Trucking rates were regulated, and which trucking companies could, you know, ship things where, and which railroads could ship things where. That was all determined by the government.
So those measures had become an impediment to American companies trying to beat global competitors?
Well, in those instances, they had been an impediment to economic growth because they were impediment to innovation and competition.
Domestically.
Domestically. And by the way, when we regulated those industries, which was a long time ago, electric utilities, we still do to some extent, they were natural monopolies for technological reasons as well as, you know, sort of economic reasons. And it made sense if you had to have a monopoly that you should regulate certainly its prices or its profits or something like that. But by the time we deregulated those things in the late 70s and early 80s, there was no need to do that, as has been demonstrated. And that unleashed a huge amount of innovation and efficiency and lower prices. We travel for much cheaper than people used to travel to many more places with a lot more regularity and on an inflation-adjusted basis. Freight rates are down, and we pay less for telephone service or what we now, you know, call digital service. And we have all sorts of contraptions that we use to communicate with each other in all sorts of ways. So that would not have happened as fast if all that had been deregulated. The question, though, goes to another matter, which is, were we in a competitiveness problem by the end of the 70s and the early 80s? And yes, it was a big problem. And magazine covers trumpeted our competitiveness problem, and books were written about how the Japanese were overtaking us and the Germans were overtaking us. And it looked like we were going to go the way of Britain, a declining superpower. And so we did need to do something. And that speech that you played from Wall Street, where Gordon Gekko says we're going to save the USA, we needed to make our corporations, frankly, a little meaner and leaner so that they could compete, because we were having our lunch eaten by these foreign competitors who either had better products or they had cheaper products.
So Gordon Gekko was preaching greed in like 1987. We are in a very different environment now. Why are so many people still vilifying regulation?
You know, that's a good question. They are, because what happened is we needed to change the way we did business and the way we did regulation in the 80s, as I said. And in order to make those changes, we had to actually embrace a set of ideas that could rationalize those things. It had to make sense. There needed to be a story that needed to be told. And so we embraced a series of ideas that were useful at that time. One was that greed was good. Well, to put it a little softer, that if everybody pursues his or her own individual self-interest as a consumer, as an investor, as an employee, as an employer, that if everyone does that, then, as it turns out, not only are we better off, but collectively we are all better off. And that is a very famous notion that comes to us from Adam Smith in his famous work, The Wealth of Nations, that we are led as if by an invisible hand to a better place for everybody. So that was one of the ideas. Another idea that we embraced was that if we made things more fair, that if we made things more equal, or we had rules that did, or norms that did, that we would wind up with a smaller pie. In other words, if we cut the slices more equally, we're going to wind up with a smaller pie. And if we want a bigger pie, we should allow the slices to be cut more unevenly, and everyone's slice will still be bigger because the pie will be bigger. There was another idea that we embraced, which is we don't need to worry about inequality of incomes, because what really matters to us in America is equality of opportunity. And we have the most equal opportunity in the world, and that's what matters. We can make it a little more equal, but we shouldn't worry about this other thing called inequality of, of, um, of income. So those are some ideas that we embraced, and they were useful to getting us into a better place in terms of regulation, in terms of taxes, in terms of the competitiveness of our companies, the way they were run. I think I should stop here and give a little, also one more bit of historical background.
Okay.
Between the mid-70s and the early 80s, there was a decade in which people who invested in Wall Street on average lost money on an inflation-adjusted basis. In other words, stocks didn't go up at all for an entire decade. It was a lost decade. And the reason that was so is that when we first began to get competition from overseas firms, the way companies were run, they were run, people who ran them tried to balance the interests of workers and customers and communities and, yes, shareholders. But when the profits that those companies used to earn started to get eroded away by foreign competition, the shareholders were the ones who were sort of left with the short end of the stick. And after a decade, they sort of said, we've had enough of this. And they began to force their priority onto companies. And they did that through a series of takeovers, hostile takeovers. That in the mid-1970s, they were financed by these new things called junk bonds. And these hostile takeovers tended to focus the minds of chief executives who realized that if they didn't start to make a good return to shareholders, that they were going to get their company bought out and they were going to get thrown out the door. And so a big change happened in terms of the focus of companies, which is the maximizing shareholder value that you mentioned before. And that was another idea that was embraced. So we did all those things, but the problem is we took all those ideas and we have since pushed them way too far. And one of them is that regulation is always bad and taxation is always bad and redistribution is always bad.
You characterize a lot of the animosity toward taxation and regulation as mindless. Who's leading the charge to gut regulatory agencies in favor of unfettered pursuit of corporate profit?
In general, the business community. It used to be that, you know, one industry would say, well, don't regulate us so tightly, but it's okay if you regulate those other industries. Now, the Chamber of Commerce has really led the way, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on this, and convinced the business community that we all have to stick together, and that if we fight the regulation in the oil industry, that's good because it creates a political environment in which regulation is considered bad, and that will help people in every other industry. And it's sort of like, you know, a joint protection racket. They all agree to support deregulation of everything, even though they only have each industry only has an interest in their own particular slice of it. But they basically all agreed to use, and you will see it in Republican rhetoric, which is whenever you say regulation, it's always says job killing regulation. That regulation is always bad for innovation. It's always bad for growth. It always raises costs. You know, sometimes regulation does raise costs, but, you know, it might save lives, for example, or it might make us think that things are fairer, or it might make us healthier. It might make there be more competition where there may be an inadequate competition. So regulation can have positive and negative effects. You have to look at them, and they're not all economic either, but you have to look at it and balance it. But the Chamber of Commerce is always saying, oh, yeah, we're for good regulation. We're just not for bad regulation. But in terms of major regulation for the last 25 years, they never found a regulation that they thought was good.
So in other words, if you press them to say, okay, what is reasonable, they're hard-pressed to come up with answers, except things, I guess, that are really obvious to everyone.
Well, you know, they say they're for clean air, and they trumpet the fact that we've made great strides in clean air and clean water. But, you know, every time the Trump administration gets in and every industry is trying to use this anti-regulatory argument to chip away at the regulations that have created that clean air and that clean water.
Stephen Perlstein is my guest. He is Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University and a columnist for The Washington Post. His new book is Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed Is Not Good, Opportunity Is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Stephen Perlstein, who is Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize as columnist for The Washington Post, and author of a new book called Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed Is Not Good, Opportunity Is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. Steve, you explore the concept here that is called market justice. What does that mean in theory, market justice?
It's a term that I have sort of used to describe the way pro-market people justify the things that a lot of people find distasteful, morally distasteful about capitalism in America today. And it's sort of say that market justice, the arguments of market justice are, for one thing, whatever we earn in the marketplace is ours. It's our property, and we own it. And if you try to take it away from us, particularly to give to somebody else, that's theft. And underlying this this belief is the belief that markets are an objective measure of each of our economic contribution. That if I make $40,000 a year, that is my, and this is the word, the language of economics, my marginal, it reflects my marginal productivity. That is how much I add to the productivity of my company and therefore of the economy. And it's an objective measure. And because it's objective, we should all, you know, basically treat it as sacred. And the property that you earn as a result of your work should be yours. And, you know, don't touch my stuff. And that does appeal to a moral instinct that we all have. People think, people do believe that people should get to keep what they earn. Here's the problem with that, Chris. The market actually isn't an objective measure of it at all. It's a quite subjective measure. Yes, somebody, it does reflect some objective differences in talent and how hard you work and how creative you work or how much risk-taking you're willing to take. But market income also reflects the rules by which competition is waged and the norms that, the social norms that businesses and society impose on all of us that affects the outcome. So for example, if we raise the minimum wage, then suddenly the marginal productivity of all the people who work at Amazon goes up. Well, wait a minute. Are they any less productive the day before as opposed to the day after? No, they're doing the same thing. But we have changed the rules so that their market income changes. And there are lots of rules that affect this distribution of income. Antitrust laws, minimum wage laws, laws having to do with whether we have slavery or not, whether we have unions or not, whether companies get to have monopolies or not. All of these things affect marginal, so-called marginal productivity or market income. And because of that, you can't say that the market is purely objective in making its decisions on what everybody earns, because these reflect these socially and politically determined rules and norms. So I'll give you another example. In the 1950s, chief executive officers had all the same powers that they have today. In fact, their boards of directors were probably more pliant back then than they are today. And yet, in the 1950s and 60s, no chief executive would ever have thought to pay himself, and they were almost all hims, himself, what these guys pay themselves today. Hmm. They wouldn't have, it would never occur to them. And it would not have occurred to them because it would have been socially unacceptable. Unacceptable not only to their employees, maybe unacceptable to their customers if they knew about it, but it would have been unacceptable to other chief executives. And at the, when they would sit down, if they had, if they met one of these other chief executives at the country club, they'd say, hey, cut that out. Don't do that. You make us all look bad. You'll make socialists out of Americans. So there was a social norm against these things. And as you probably have observed, that particular social norm went out with 23 skidoo. You know, I mean, you know, there's no shame now in what these guys pay themselves. And, you know, we have a guy who runs a very successful private equity firm, Steve Schwarzman, who runs the Blackstone Group. Last year, his compensation, including the dividends he got from all the stock that he owns for this company that he helped to start, his compensation was $789 million in one year. And the year before was only $450 million, but the year before that it was $725 million. Now, you know, that's the equivalent of 15,000 public school teachers.
Wow.
Do you really think that, does he really think that he deserves that? And although I tried to ask him that question, I didn't get an answer. I suspect his answer is, yeah, well, I earned it in the marketplace, in the competitive free marketplace. Anyone else was free to compete with me or to do what I did, but I did it, and I did it better than everybody else, and so that's what I deserve. That's my just dessert. That sounds right, but remember that if I change, I could change three or four different rules or laws, and instead of 785 or six or whatever he earned, he might have only earned 600 million. You know, these rules have a powerful effect on the distribution of income.
So, as you mentioned, a lot of executive compensation packages now include significant shares of whatever corporation people work for. How has that reality shaped the priorities of CEOs in deciding that the number one priority will be shareholder returns?
Well, that is the number one way in which the behavior and the norms of corporate behavior have changed. What the Wall Street did and investors did is say, look, the only way we can make sure that these CEOs don't do what they were doing in the 1950s and 60s, which was, you know, balancing all these things, maybe to our detriment, is we will load them up with stocks and stock options and things related to the thing we care about. So they will have interests that are perfectly aligned with our interests. In a sense, they've bribed and handsomely bribed CEOs to do their bidding and to put shareholders first. And it's not just a sense of, well, okay, well, we'll balance shareholder interests with other interests. It's you put us first. If there's any close call to make, if there's any extra surplus, it goes to us, not to them. You pay them the minimum you have to pay them, or give them the minimum service you have to give the customers, or treat the community with the minimum respect that you have to get away with what we need to do. But anything more than that, that comes to the shareholders. That comes to us. And that's, they've used executive compensation very successfully as a way to focus the mind of chief executives in public companies.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. We have Dana calling first from Frisco. Hi, Dana.
I think you mean Donna. Is that possible?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, Donna. It was, sorry about that. Go right ahead.
That's okay. Professor Perlstein, this is very interesting. I'd like you to comment on, one, why don't the board of directors tell the CEOs, no, you can't have $750 million compensation this year? And number two, could you comment on the famous scene where a group of CEOs is gathered shortly after the Trump tax cuts, and they're asked to raise their hands if they're going to take the tax cut money and put it into, you know, expansion and increased employee compensation? And only two or three raised their hands, and Gary Cohn said, why aren't the rest of you raising your hands?
Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for calling in, Donna. Why don't directors, limit executive compensation? There's a variety of reasons. Again, it's become the norm. They hire these fancy consultants that, give them an estimate of what they think is the right way to structure the compensation packages. But here's the thing. No company wants to think of itself as below average, right? You want to think of yourself as, a good company in your industry and successful. So if every company wants to think of itself as above average, therefore every company wants to have an above average CEO, therefore every company wants to pay its CEO above average, well, as you in public radio know, only in Lake Wobegon can everybody be above average. That has a tendency to just have everybody leapfrogging over everybody else. Also, a lot of corporate directors are CEOs themselves, so they're not inclined to push that hard. I will tell you this, however. I once asked Vernon Jordan, who is sort of a super lawyer who lives in Washington, I once asked him this same question that you asked me. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, you don't know what they asked for. As in, we give them less than they asked for, but they asked for even more. Nobody likes to go. There's a threat. There's a threat. If I don't pay my CEO a lot, he's going to get picked off and poached. Someone's going to recruit him, and so we have to keep the pay high in order to avoid having a turnover at the top, which can be very disruptive. Your second question about how the corporate tax cut proceeds are being used is a big article today by my former colleague at the Post, Jim Tankersley, who's now at the New York Times, and that lays that out pretty clearly. Very little has gone to higher employee pay, and actually very little has actually gone to investment of any sort in the company, whether it be R&D or new plant and equipment. Some has, a little more than there was before the tax cut, but not anywhere near the amount of money that's been put into corporate coffers. Most of that money has been used to pay dividends and essentially to artificially raise stock prices by buying back shares on the open market.
My guest is Stephen Pearlstein. We're talking about his book, Can American Capitalism Survive? You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to be clear here, Steve. You say that there is a difference between maximizing shareholder profits at the expense of everything else and striving to provide a consistent above average, there we go again with above average, return for shareholders. So you're saying we don't have to ignore every other calculus in favor of shareholders' profits. There is a way to do some of both.
Yes, that's the way companies used to be run, and that's the way some companies are run today. And here's my beef about maximizing shareholder value. I would be fine if a company wants to say, we're going to be ruthless profit maximizers, and we're going to tell everybody that ahead of time, our customers, our employees, our shareholders, and that's the way we're going to run our company. What I object to is the fact that this is a priority that is essentially imposed by Wall Street and to some degree by the Delaware courts on every corporation. And so if you want to run a different kind of company, you're not only punished by Wall Street, but the directors may feel that they are avoiding their fiduciary duty, which is actually false. They don't have a fiduciary duty to the shareholders. They have a fiduciary duty to the corporation. But if companies wanted to run by, a different set of metrics or a different set of priorities, it seems to me they ought to be free to do so, to tell everybody ahead of time so they know. So if shareholders don't want to invest in that kind of company, they don't have to. But let a thousand flowers bloom. What I think would happen is that those companies would tend to be preferred by consumers. They would tend to be preferred by young and well-trained and educated employees who could work at a number of places. They might even be preferred by some shareholders and investors. And I think what the experience shows is that companies that do run themselves more for the long term and don't try to maximize short-term shareholder value, that those companies actually have better long-term returns than the ones that say maximizing shareholder value is our lone star, our North Star.
Not every corporation deals directly with consumers, but I wonder what the effect is on consumers of this effort to maximize shareholder profit. Do we end up paying more for the things we buy at the store, Steve?
No, I don't think so. Actually, I would say that it's not so much we pay more. The product markets are pretty competitive these days. There are exceptions like cable television, but no, I would say they're pretty. Where we see it is in where sometimes they defraud customers, and a lot of times the service is bad. You know, when you get on a telephone and dial an 800 number to call a big company, and you have to wait there for 25 minutes in order to talk to a human being, you should understand that companies know exactly how long their customers are on the phone, and they could buy a package from the company that operates the call center. They could buy a package that says you can wait on average 25 minutes, or you can buy a package that says they wait on average 15 minutes, or you can buy a package that says wait 5 minutes. Hmm. And they've chosen the 25-minute package. So it comes out more in service. And it also comes out in defrauding. I mean, look at Wells Fargo. You know that controversy from a few years ago. Wells Fargo, it turns out, put so much pressure on its employees to upsell its existing customers, that is, to sell them additional products, that when the employees couldn't actually sell the additional products, they sort of signed their customers up anyway. And it didn't cost the customers anything right away until such time as maybe their credit ratings were affected by it, or they started getting, these little bills for things that they had never purchased. And now Wells Fargo has had years of trying to resuscitate its reputation as an honest financial services company, and they're running ads that maybe you have them in Dallas, trying to convince you that this is the new Wells Fargo, and they've paid, tens of billions of dollars in fine. And a lot of banks did that during the 2007-2008 period, 2006-2007-2008 period. They're so pressured to deliver double-digit earnings growth to Wall Street investors every year that when push comes to shove, they think their jobs are on the line and they'll do what they had to do. You in Dallas may remember the so-called Enron scandal. Those guys mixed up their books, and they did it to impress their shareholders. In other words, they lied to their shareholders in order to maximize their shareholders' interests.
My guest is Steven Pearlstein. We're talking about his book, Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed is Not Good, Opportunity is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Steven Pearlstein. He is a columnist for the Washington Post. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and he is Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University. His book is called Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed is Not Good, Opportunity is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. How, aside from a wage hike, Steve, could we redistribute wealth in America without falling into the trap of some kind of bloated socialist system that seems to be every CEO's worst nightmare?
And we probably wouldn't want to go there. I mean, you have to remember that even Sweden 15, 20 years ago decided that it was had tax rates that were too high and spending that was too high and reduced it. So there is a happy medium somewhere, probably a pretty wide range of happy mediums depending on culture and history, but we're probably on the wrong side of that sweet spot right now. So what could we do? Well, the first thing I would say is that this is America. I'm aware of the politics of America. So we should try as best as possible to change the distribution of income indirectly rather than directly. That is, rather than taxing rich people at very high rates and then taking the money and just giving it to everybody else, we probably would do better to change the rules and norms by which business operate that, as I mentioned earlier, has an effect on how income is distributed. There's a word that's been coined for this. It's called pre-distribution rather than redistribution. And it's and because it's not as visible, it's more acceptable to us. We as a country, a lot of Americans don't like welfare, and they particularly don't welfare to people who don't work. And so we have to do some of that, but we probably ought to minimize that. In my book, I have an idea for what's referred to by a lot of people as a universal basic income, UBI. I call it something different, and for both political reasons as well as economic. I think that every American citizen, including children, should receive a dividend every year from the government to reflect their citizenship and to reflect the fact that we all have inherited a great country and a great economy that none of us created, and we all deserve to share in that bounty equally. And the suggestion is that everybody receive $3,000 a year at the same time, no matter what their income is. And that people who work get an extra, or who go to school, that is, go to school past grade 12, get $3,000 as if they were working. And if you did that, you could eliminate most poverty in the United States. Even for people working at the minimum wage. I would supplement that with the existing, that might supplement that with the existing earned income tax credit. You might supplement it with some things like food stamps and help for child care services, for example. But you also might use that dividend to eliminate some of our categorical welfare programs. Now, having said that, that would be a deal. You get the dividend. On the other hand, every American would have an obligation to serve the country for 3 years sometime during their life, public service. So there's responsibility and there's privilege. Privilege is you get the dividend. Responsibility is you owe the country 3 years of service. It could be when you're older. It could be when you're young. And the idea there is to build this sense of mutual commitment and mutual responsibility and that we're all in this together. Now, how would I pay for that? That's a good question. And the answer is basically I'd change the tax rate so that if you earn more than, I don't know, your household earn more than something like $75,000 a year, it starts to get taken away from you. So by the time you get to, say, twice the median income of the country, you basically get it taxed away. Now, why would you give money with one hand and take it away with the other? Again, to reinforce this idea that we're all equal and we're all equal inheritors of this country and we have an equal obligation to serve the country. So that's one idea. Another is profit sharing. And there are things we could do with the tax code that would say to corporations, look, if you want to pay these big bonuses and give stock options to top executives, that's fine. We'll give you a favorable tax treatment of that, but you can only do that if you also have a broad profit-sharing program so that frontline employees get to share in the success or the lack of success of your company. So that's another thing we could do to make sure things were a little more equal.
What do you make of the arguments that social welfare programs, as they exist today, certainly they benefit the working poor, but, you know, practically speaking, they benefit corporations that employ the working poor, right? Like, so a mega corporation that only pays minimum wage or just a little bit more doesn't really have to think about the extra needs that are unmet for its full-time employees because these programs that, you know, provide SNAP benefits and housing benefits will sort of fill in the gap.
Yes, that is a fairly valid and common argument. And that's why, so for example, we have a thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which essentially the government supplements the wages of low-wage workers. They have to work, but then the government supplements them. And it's been a very effective program in lifting people out of poverty. But you don't want to rely exclusively on that because of the reason you said. So you, that works best if you have a minimum wage. And a minimum wage that's at least at the federal level is probably higher than we have now. It doesn't have to be $15, but higher than $7.25. And those two things work together so that not all the burden is put on the companies. Now, remember, when you say something burdens a company, the companies have to shift that burden to someone somewhere, and there's only three choices. They can shift it to their customers and higher prices, to their shareholders and lower profits and returns, or other they can shift it to other employees in the form of lower wages. So the burden of making companies pay more, it's not always the shareholder that pays more. You want to be careful about it. It could be the customers or the other employees who pay more.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Ramos on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ramos.
Hi. I think these outside of homegrown terrorism, this is the number one most important conversation that we can have. I think if your guest would be the advisor to any Democratic politician, they would win every election. I think also the most important thing is fairness will not make us poor, and that's the key. Reagan has done a lot of damage during the Cold War, where he managed to convince the baby boomers that socialism equals communism. Therefore, any kind of social programs, anything that has to do with it, has the word social in it, any social benefits is not good for the country and it equals communism. And unfortunately, that's embedded in their heads and their minds. And even if you put proof, black and white, in front of them, they refuse to see it. So until the baby boomers die and they go away, nothing will ever change.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I'm smack in the middle of the baby boom generation, so I suppose Ramos will be cheering for my demise in the next couple of years. He makes, though, a point that I spent an entire chapter in this book making, which is there used to be in economics a belief that there is an absolute trade-off between fairness and growth, that you can have more of one or more of the other, but you know, you give up one if you want more of the other. And it is true in a lot of instances. That is, in a lot of European countries, like France, for example, or Italy, if you had more, if you had a little less fairness and you had a little more competitiveness in the labor market and there were chances of earning bigger prizes, you probably would have a bigger pie. But we're on the other side of that sweet spot. And it's not just me who says that. It's like the economists at the IMF, or the which is the International Monetary Fund, which is not exactly known as a hotbed of socialist thinking. And they've done a pretty comprehensive study looking across a lot of countries over a long periods of time. And what they find is that when you get too much inequality, you actually reduce growth. And this is a little bit like Perlstein, the economics professor, talking, but I think you can intuit this. Imagine a world in which no matter how hard you work, how much risk you take, how talented you were, that everyone in the country got paid the exact same amount. That's pure kibbutz. Well, what we know is that those kinds of economies don't grow very fast. So that's true, and the market people will point that out to you. But let me give you the other extreme. Imagine a world in which no matter how hard you work, how talented you were, how much risk you were willing to take, that everybody in the country other than three families basically got subsistence wages. That just to make sure you didn't die. Well, you can imagine that wouldn't be a very productive or high-growth economy either. So what we know just from this little sort of thought experiment is that you can go too far in either direction. There isn't necessarily a trade-off everywhere at all times. There are times when the trade-off is between fairness and growth, but there are times when there's a trade-off between unfairness and growth. And I suspect we're in that territory now.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any complication, Steve, in putting wage earners in one bucket, CEOs in another, and corporate shareholders in a third, because in some cases, at least, wage earners are certainly also shareholders because their retirement savings are, say, tied up in the stock market.
Sure. We're all consumers. We're all producers. And, you know, if anybody has any kind of savings or pension programs, we're all investors too. So, though having said that, most of the wealth, that is, most of the savings in the world is in the United States is held by people in the top 20%. But you always want to be balancing these interests if you're running a company, and if you're running a country, you want to balance these interests. And it's balance that people want. It's not that they want, you know, I mean, there are some people who want, you know, workers over everybody else. And there are other people who want the environment over everybody else. You know, the country wouldn't really work so well if we did that. I'm just suggesting that this pendulum swung much too far toward the owners of capital and toward investors. And it needs to swing back a little bit. And in order to do that, we have to get rid of these sort of ideas that we pushed to a great extent in order to explain why and to understand how far the pendulum would come back. I bet a lot of your listeners, for example, Chris, think there's too much income inequality in the United States. Most Americans believe that. But let me ask you a tough question. If you think the level of inequality that we have now is too much, what would be the right amount? That's not a question that answers itself very easily. So everyone thinks it's too much, but if I ask you, well, okay, what would be the right? And what would be the right amount? It's hard. But it's not that everyone should be perfect equality. We know that's not the right solution. In fact, I asked a lot of people that question for the book, and a lot of the answers were pretty – these are all liberals, by the way, I asked, who couldn't really answer that question very convincingly. But – I think the best answers I actually got were from political scientists and from philosophers. And their answer, I think, was telling, and I agree with it. You know when there's too much inequality, when it starts to erode the social capital, which is a fancy economist's word for the trust and level of cooperation that we have with each other. And we in the United States have the lowest levels of social capital of almost anywhere in the Western world other than Italy and Israel, actually. But that we have, and it's been going down. We are beginning to be a divided nation, an untrusting nation, looking out for ourselves rather than the whole. And we see that in our politics all the time. And when we have polarized politics and lack of social capital, we have a dysfunctional government. And when you have a dysfunctional government, it isn't very long before it starts to affect the performance of your economy. And we're beginning to see that. And so what I would say, as some of these people who wrote me back saying, is you know when we have too much inequality, when it begins to erode the trust and willingness to cooperate that are so important in an advanced capitalist economy. Because if that is the grease that greases the machinery of capitalism, it's also the grease that greases the machinery of democracy.
Stephen Pearlstein is Robinson Professor of Public Affairs at George Mason University, a columnist for The Washington Post, and author of Can American Capitalism Survive? Why Greed is Not Good, Opportunity is Not Equal, and Fairness Won't Make Us Poor. Steve, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and use any podcast app you like or your smart speaker to listen to the Think podcast. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.